So I'm from Whitefish, Montana, and I started writing murder mysteries, about 6 years ago. I actually published my first book in 2015, and so this is my fourth one. It's called A Sharp Solitude, and I'm going to read a little bit from that later in just a little bit. But first, I'm just going to talk about kind of my journey to becoming a crime fiction writer, a writer of suspense, which is kind of the genre that I'm in mostly. And even though I tend to lean a little bit to the literary side with my books. And so I did not start out writing a ton like when I was a little girl. I didn't like journal a lot. I actually am a little bit unusual because I didn't spend a ton of time even reading. In fact, my third grade teacher told me that I had problems with reading. They pulled my mom and dad in and said maybe we should hold her back. And my dad said, no, it's just because she's really shy. And it was true back then in third grade. They would make – I mean the thing was – times tables were the same way. They'd make you stand up. What's 7 times 8? What's 6 times 9? And it would be like, I couldn't do it. And so the same thing was for reading. They'd make me stand up and they'd read, and I was just too shy and I just had trouble with it. And so they thought that I couldn't read, but there was a little bit of element of truth to it. I did have a little bit of trouble with reading. I think I was the last, I was the youngest of three children, and my mom actually was from Europe and didn't, I'm not blaming her, but she didn't speak, she was just learning to speak English when I was little, and so I don't think she kind of sat down and read a ton of books to me. That sounds like I'm blaming my mom, doesn't it? But it is important to read to your kids when they're little. It really makes a difference in how they read as they grow older. And I had a little bit of trouble with reading. And so I had this approach avoidance kind of thing going on with books for a long time when I was little and as I grew older, even into high school and even into college. I was a little nervous about keeping up with the reading, with the college load and things like that. But as time went on, I worked through it. I did not get held back. I was shy. They realized that. I went on and I kind of, in a way, tackled all this. And I think on some level, I must have wanted to show that third grade teacher that I can do this. Not only can I read, but I can write books, damn it. But it's not just that. I also, my grandmother was a writer. She had published a lot of YA, young adult literature. And I think it kind of ran in the family a little bit. And I wanted to pursue that as I got older. I think when I was in college, it started to really dawn on me that I want to write a story down and I want to write a long story and I kind of want to write a novel. And I don't know where that little voice came from. Steven Spielberg has this line that your dreams don't shout at you, they whisper to you. And that's kind of exactly the way it was for me. It wasn't like, you want to be a writer and study it, do it, go to MFA, you know, get your MFA. It wasn't like that for me at all. In fact, I don't even have an MFA. I have a degree in linguistics, a master's degree in linguistics, and I did. So I kind of nudged up close to English that way, but I took a bunch of literature courses in my linguistics degree, and I actually taught some literature at Flathead Valley Community College, but mostly I taught kind of writing composition classes and linguistics and remedial writing and things like that. And so anyway, somewhere in my 20s, I decided I'm going to try and write a book. And in my late 20s, I got up the nerve and wrote my first book. It was a non-genre novel that I didn't really do anything with. It took me 4 years to finish, but I was really proud of it that I finished. And I looked into the idea of getting an agent or finding my way into New York publishing, but it was very, very difficult. And it still is very difficult, except for now, at least you get to like send emails and look on the internet and find agencies and agents and use Query Tracker and all these devices that help you navigate that world. Back then, it was like you go get a big, fat book that publisher's marketplace that tells you, you know, it's like a huge directory of just all these agents, most of them in New York City, but some of them in San Francisco or Chicago or big cities. And you just find what kind of matches what you think might be what you write. And then back then you just sent the query letter and you sent the maybe the first 15 pages if that's what they allowed you to do. But most of the time it was just you sent a query letter and then they'd mail you back, snail mail, And you'd go to your mailbox and find out, well, do they want the rest of my work or not? Do they even want to see it or not? And most of the time it would be a big fat rejection, like, no, we don't want to see it. And if you were lucky enough where they wanted to see it, then you'd mail some pages, not even the whole thing usually. You'd mail like the first three chapters, and then you would get a letter back months and months later. And you would go to the mailbox every day hoping to get that letter that said they want to see the rest of the manuscript, and instead you'd get the big fat rejection that said, no, we don't want to see this. So anyway, it was, I didn't do a ton of that, but I did enough of it to go, okay, I am way too insecure for this business. And so I put that aside. I thought, well, I'll just write another novel. So I wrote another non-genre novel. That one took me 2 years, so I kind of cut the time in half. Still teaching at FVCC, Flathead Valley Community College in my hometown area, and had a little boy by then, and was married, had a boy, young boy, and I wrote this novel 2 years, and I was thinking maybe this one I could get a little more nerve up to go through that whole snail mail, snail mailing agents, and you know, trying to get an agent, go through that process. But right around the time I was trying to decide that, my life kind of fell apart, my marriage fell apart, and I ended up going through divorce and going into survival mode. And I just thought, who am I to think that I'm going to do this writing thing? So I put it completely aside and continued to teach at the college, but also got into technical writing, which is something I could do to make extra money and, you know, work late at night on my computer when my little boy was in bed and that kind of thing. And it worked out well, except for there was no time for creative writing at the end of the day. And so I just, like I said, I thought, well, this isn't for me. It was just a pipe dream. And I put it aside for over 10 years. And then other things happened in my life. I somehow got into Pilates, probably because I got this weird shoulder thing from using the mouse all the time with the technical writing. And my therapist, I remember saying, do Pilates. It'll help your neck, your back. So I did. And then I would get asked, because I was an English teacher, I would get asked to sub Pilates classes. And I would be like, well, teach English. But they'd go, oh, you're fine. Just get up there and teach. You know how to teach. And so I would get up and sub these Pilates classes. And eventually I thought, well, if I'm teaching, subbing Pilates classes, I should get certified. So I did higher and higher levels until I one day ended up owning a Pilates studio and having, you know, all the equipment that goes with that. And so I started to teach that. And I remarried. My husband Jamie is here. And in the meantime, and my life just kind of changed and got more flexible in some ways and harder in other ways, because we combined families and I had two more children, stepchildren. And so, but I really enjoyed the Pilates thing, and it allowed me to leave the technical writing. No offense to technical writers, but for me it was very monotonous work. And so I was able to leave that behind, and the flexibility, no pun intended, with the Pilates really allowed me to get back into the creative writing. So that's when I dove into my first novel. It was called The Wild Inside. And the way I came about that is that I thought, you know, this time when I come back to these novels, I'm not going to try and do the non-genre thing that I did earlier in, you know, the 10 years before. And I'm going to really approach this with a lot of intent and purpose. And I'm gonna write what I like to read. And by then I'd really discovered, like I said, I didn't read a ton as a child, so I wasn't reading every Agatha Christie or every Sherlock Holmes out there. It was something that I came across that I started to do after I got out of college, really this enjoyment with mysteries. And so I thought, well, I wanna write one of those. And so I thought, well, but what? Like, what kind of a plot? What are you gonna do? And where? Because for me, mysteries, like atmospheric mysteries, were my favorite. Like mysteries that took place in really mysterious countryside places, or really fascinating, you know, like Dublin or Glasgow, or you know, the London countryside, or just really, you know, Dennis Lehane's Boston, places where you could really feel like the sense of place. And so that was my first choice, is where is my setting going to be? What am I going to do for this? And at the time I thought, you know, does anybody really want to read about Kalispell, Montana, like Cowtown, Montana? And you know, everybody says, write what you know. That's like the golden rule, write what you know. And you know, we could talk about that. That's a debatable topic. However, I did feel on some level like if I'm going to approach this as deliberately as I want to and with focus, I do want to just dive in and really write what I know. Because those first two non-genre novels that I wrote earlier in my life were not set in Montana. You know, they were set. One was set in Seattle. One was actually set in New York City, which don't ask me why. I had no experience with New York City, and I attempted to write that novel in New York City. But anyway, so this time I was like, I'm going to be smart. I'm going to write where I live, a place that I really know and love. But I struggle with this idea that, like, does anybody want to read about this town, really? And so it dawned on me at some point that I have Glacier National Park right next door to me. And not only is it gorgeous, but it's kind of haunting in a way and very stark and desolate in many places. And very much the equivalent of kind of the Scandi noir and environment, which had gotten really big about 15 years ago. And so I thought, well, why not Glacier National Park? It's federal land. I could use a special agent if I wanted to. And that's exactly what I did. So I kind of had my story, had a few legs for the story at that point. And I decided that I would have a special agent who comes from the Department of the Interior, who comes in from Denver to investigate a pretty serious crime that occurs there in Glacier. And Glacier just happens to be a place he does not want to be, because when he was young, his dad was killed and mauled by a grizzly bear while he was camping there one night with him. So he has all this backstory and kind of psychological trauma that is going on while he's investigating a case there. And that book really was my debut novel. I was able to sell it. The whole agent process was much simpler. Like I said, I could use email, and that just kind of worked out. And I got a contract in New York. And so here I am 4 books later with Sharp Solitude. My second book was called Mortal Fall. And when I went to New York to meet my agent, because I only knew her through email and speaking to her on the phone, when I went there to meet her and then meet a couple of the editors who'd made offers on The Wild Inside, I sat down with them, and all of them asked, so because The Wild Inside has this beautiful, see on this book there's a wolf right in this corner, well there's a beautiful grizzly on The Wild, I wish I had that to show you, but there's a beautiful little grizzly bear right in the same place for The Wild Inside. And sure, I can show everybody. So this was the first one. And you see that little tiny grizzly bear. I have another story about that, because they asked me, they said, do you have any ideas for the cover, you know? I said, not really. I just know that I don't want a grizzly bear. Because there's a grizzly that's in this book, a beautiful, magnificent grizzly that I write about in this book. But I did not want a grizzly bear on the cover, because it's like those grocery books you see in the grocery store with the teeth and the claws. And it's just like, you know, that we capitalize on here in Montana near Yellowstone, near Glacier. And it's like that's not the look I wanted. And, you know, so I said, I don't want a bear on the cover of my book. So lo and behold, I open my email, the image comes up, and there's the bear. But it was a beautiful, tasteful bear, and I actually went, okay, maybe I don't mind having a bear on my book. It's really beautiful. So yeah, I've come to love that little bear. In fact, I've gotten in arguments with the guy at Barnes & Noble, because apparently at Barnes & Noble, if you autograph a book, the sticker that says autograph copy has to go in the lower left corner above the author's name, which is exactly where that grizzly is. And remember that? I'm not going to name towns. And he was putting the sticker right perfectly over the bear. I'm like, could you please not do that? Could you please not put the sticker over that beautiful grizzly bear? And, well, that's company rules. And I said, well, can you just do it on the other side? And he said, no. And now, a lot of other Barnes & Nobles have not done that. It was just that one particular Barnes & Noble where I had a rule follower that plastered the sticker over every grizzly bear that was on there. But no big deal in the long run, but just kind of funny. And back to my story about going to New York and meeting my editors. So they said, because I have this grizzly bear, they said, well, what animal are you going to put in your next book? And I hadn't even thought of my next book. I hadn't even thought of a story or anything. For me, getting published was publishing this one book and getting it on the shelves. And that was that. I was going to publish a book in my life. And I was so excited to be on my way to that dream. And I really wasn't thinking about future books. And they said, well, what animal are you going to put in your next book? And I just was kind of caught off guard. And I said, a Wolverine? And so, you know, anything to get that book publishing contract in New York. And so, you know, a year later, I come out with this book called Mortal Fall. And it's not only about Wolverines, but it does involve some of the research that went on Glacier Park about the diminishing Wolverine populations. A wildlife biologist is killed. And so that was my second novel. My third novel is called The Weight of Night, and it involves a kidnapping of a young boy from one of the campgrounds in Glacier while kind of the park is being consumed by fires, which is pretty much what's been happening in the last several years, and last year as well when the book came out. So dealt with the fire thing and how firefighters fight those fires. Did as much research as I could. I'm sure I got a thing or two wrong with it, but, you know, I do my best with research for that kind of stuff because I don't have a law enforcement background, and I certainly don't have a Wolverine background or a grizzly background or a firefighting background. A Sharp Solitude, this just came out in June, very end of May, but they call it a June book. I don't know why. It came out on May 29th, but because of that, they call it a June book. And this involves a FBI agent who works locally in one of the resident agencies in the Flathead, and she is introduced in The Weight of Night. In fact, I should say that all four of these books are standalones, and they're not... But they're called the Glacier Mystery Series, and that is because Glacier or that area is kind of a common theme, and it's the common denominator in all the books. And what I do, it's kind of an ensemble series, is I pluck a character and I bring them into the next book that was a side character in a previous book. So I like to play through the whole arc of a character usually when I write a book. And so that formula just really works well for me rather than having one character that I'm just going to follow book after book after book. And so she's the lead character in this book, and an ex of hers who she had a child with, who is not an ex-husband, but she had a relationship with him. They had a child together, and he's the other lead character in this book. And I'm in both of their voices, hers and his. And I'm going to read from you a little bit from here, and then... So one of the questions I get is about, is it hard to write from the male voice? And I'm not going to be reading a section with the male voice, only the female voice in this, but do know that I do like to write the male voice, the male perspective. My first two books were entirely from the male perspective. I had two older brothers, so. I'm going to read most of the first chapter to you. The story starts with the FBI agent. Her name is Allie Page, and that's what it says at the top of the page. Allie, present, Thursday. I imagine it like this. The 2 9-year-old boys, Reeve and his friend Sam, lounge lazily on the couch watching the Cartoon Network at home in Reeve's parents' ranch-style single-story home on a hot summer day in Tallahassee, Florida. Reeve's mom and dad are both at work, his mom cutting hair at a local salon called Sasha's, and his dad selling beds at the mattress firm. The blinds are pulled down to block the afternoon sun, and harsh spears of light stab between the slits in the darkened living room. They've eaten an entire bag of Doritos when Sam sits up straight and turns to Reeve. "Let's do something," he says. "These shows are so boring." "What do you want to do?" Reeve asks. "I don't know, anything. Want to go outside?" "Too hot," Sam groans. Reeve pries himself away from the couch cushion and sits forward, wiping his Dorito-stained fingers on the side of his shorts. "I wish it was already my birthday," Reeve says, thinking of the day just a few weeks away, August 7th. "Me too. You gonna have a party?" "Probably. I think my parents got me a Nintendo." "No way," Sam says. "I swear." "Yeah, where is it?" "I don't know." "Where would they hide it?" Sam asks. "I don't know," Reeve shrugs. "Probably in their bedroom." A mischievous expression brightens Sam's face, one familiar to Reeve. It's one he's seen many times, the product of their age, 2 9-year-old boys eager to explore. Once, When they were playing by a creek, Sam found some old shark's teeth mixed up in the gravel, and after they'd plucked them all out and put them in a plastic bag they'd gotten from Sam's mom, Sam wanted to find more. He insisted they cross the creek to the other side, but Reeve knew water moccasins nested in that part of the stream where it was deep and cool from lush ferns draping over the water. "I don't think we should," Reeve said. Reeve was a cautious boy. Nobody would have ever described him as a daredevil, but Sam, he didn't mind taking risks. "See you on the other side, scaredy cat," he had called out as he took off his sneakers and fearlessly waded into the water. "Let's look," Sam says, getting off the couch, wearing the same expression as the time he crossed the shadowy creek. "No, my mom and dad said I can't go into their room." "Oh, come on." He runs out of the family room, down the hallway to the master bedroom. Reeve hops off the couch and follows, worried only about the transgression of going into his parents' room for maybe a second. The room is dim like the TV room, the stiff green curtains drawn, also to block out the sun. The king-size bed is made with a stiff, gaudy floral print bedspread perfectly smooth and neatly creased in all four corners. Sam opens Reeve's parents' closet doors first and searches the floor, crouching down and shoving shoes aside to look into the corners. Then he stands and lifts his head to eye the upper shelf that he can't reach. He jumps up to see if he can get high enough to peer over the top and to the sides to spy a box big enough to hold a Nintendo. Reeve opens drawers by the bed but sees nothing but papers and envelopes containing Polaroid family photos, school portraits of him and his younger sister, progress reports from their elementary school, and other miscellaneous papers and special certificates. Sam comes over and torpedoes himself onto the bed, stands and begins hopping onto it. Reeve laughs and joins him, two giggling boys caught up in the giddiness of being in a forbidden place. They bounce as if it's a trampoline, the springs of the mattress squeaking, protesting with each landing, the bedspread no longer perfect. "What about in that chest?" Sam points to the base of the bed. "Nah, she doesn't usually put anything in there except clothes." Sam launches himself off the mattress and lands with a thump on the floor. He flings an afghan folded across the wooden chest onto the now rumpled bedspread, lifts the lid, and peers in. "Not in here," he says, moving its contents around with his free arm. "Just a blanket and a bunch of old sweaters." "Told you," Reeve hops off too, his cheeks hot and flushed from the jumping. He kneels down to look under the bed, lifting the skirt. White stringy strands worn free from under the lining of the mattress box draped down like webbing made from a huge spider. Reeve blows at them, but they fall right back into place, so he moves them aside with his hand. "Whoa," Reeve says when he spots the rifle. He's seen it only once before. He'd been out playing in the neighborhood when several other kids spotted a rattlesnake curled up in a cement drainage ditch at the end of the cul-de-sac. Word spread, and everyone in the neighborhood gathered around while his father came out to take a look. His dad told the kids and other neighbors who'd gathered to stay away from the ditch until he returned. When he did, he carried the gun, walked over with purpose, instructed all the other parents to keep their kids back. But when he looked down into the ditch, there was nothing but moss and twigs. The snake had slithered away into the brush. "Wow," Sam says, walking over to Reeve, who's kneeling beside the bed and holding the rifle across his thighs. The barrel is shiny smooth, its heft intimidating but stealth-like, and Reeve is excited to show Sam that he's not always a boar. For a second, Reeve thinks he shouldn't have pulled it from under the bed, but it's as tempting as shark's teeth, and Sam would have grabbed it if he hadn't. "Cool," Sam says. "I know," Reeve breathes hard with excitement, the back of his neck slick with sweat. He's sure the gun is not loaded, and in one quick motion, he stands and lifts the rifle to take aim at, he's not sure what, maybe the chair in the corner of the room, maybe the curtains. He barely feels his finger on the trigger when a deafening boom blasts his ears, the report so explosive and the kick so violent that he thinks he's just launched himself into something vast, like the sky or outer space. And that's where he remains, tumbling through that empty void, never really landing for a very long time. I also imagine the 6-foot diameter spatter of reddish-brown blood because he fired a .30-aught caliber rifle. The force of it at close range is quite destructive and would have blown a ragged hole through the victim, typically shattering bone and tissue. There would have been spatter on the wall, the carpet, and the bed. The bullet tore through the victim's shoulder, blew through his heart, and lodged into the wall behind them, so there would have been a hole about the size of a pea in the plaster. The boy, the shooter, attempted to stop the flow of blood by putting his hands over the wound, so ugly smears would stretch across both the victim's and the shooter's clothes. He also tried to give mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to the victim, which he'd apparently learned about in school just months before, so his DNA could be easily collected from the victim's mouth if they'd needed it, but they didn't, because the boy admitted everything. Bloodstains, as well as the spatter, would also be on the bedside table and phone, because he called 911 and frantically said, "I've shot my best friend. My best friend is dead. I didn't know my dad's gun was loaded." He shouted this in a guttural panic that was recorded by the 911 emergency service operator and would later be played over and over by the press in the aftermath of the gun control debates that eventually ensued across the state. I always consider details like this since I'm trained to look at the particulars. I used to work in the bustling Newark field office until I was transferred to a resident agency, a smaller office with only one or two agents that have jurisdiction over an area, usually someplace more rural. For an agent, the best way to gain experience is to work in a variety of settings, even if it means moving across the country to the remote resident office in Kalispell, Montana. I miss the city, but I don't mind Montana. I remember seeing the great spine of the Rockies for the first time when I drove across the eastern plains from Newark toward the Continental Divide. I'll admit I was a little freaked out at the sight of bleak fields the color of camel hair stretching into oblivion, the glimpses of old, long-abandoned cabins and wood barns buckling and decomposing onto the bare ground, the rain blowing horizontally against the ribs of horses and cows, the Blackfoot Indian town of Browning settled in the high plains like an oversized, unkempt Easter basket with its turquoise, pink, and yellow ramshackle houses, as if colorful paint were all it took to lift one out of poverty. Stray dogs run amok, and I couldn't tell if they were neglected or if they were contented community pets wandering around and being fed by local business owners and residents. It gave me an unsettled feeling that the new life I was stepping into was unprotected, not propped up by the busy cacophony of city life. But when I glimpsed the Great Divide, the way the mountains heaved out of the brown prairies toward the expanse of sky, both warmed and comforted me. I'd never seen anything like it, anything so stunning and dramatic, so separate from my sense of everyday city life. Is this why people went west? Because the mountains bucking up to kiss the expansive sky made you feel as if you could have a fresh start or reach your highest dreams? Maybe, I had thought, I could grow accustomed to a place with such striking scenery, a place with buildings no higher than two stories and people with unsuspicious eyes. It was in Montana that I met that 9-year-old shooter, Reeve Landon, when he was 29 and I was 28, and he had suspicious eyes. We began dating, and when I brought up the incident, he said, "I figured you'd find out, not because you're FBI, but because anyone Googling my name would find out. It's not really a secret. I just don't like to bring it up every time I meet someone." Reeve then recounted to me the incident that made him one of the unlucky children whose tragedies altered Florida's gun laws in the late 1980s. 10 months later, a year and a half after I had moved west, over coffee in a Starbucks, he told me he couldn't do it any longer, it referring to our blossoming relationship. He had been thinking about it for weeks. "I'm sorry," he had said. "I just can't, Allie. I thought I could, but I'm not sure I'll ever be able to." He never said it had anything to do with what happened all those years ago. But I have a good imagination, and I find myself going back to it, running my mind over and over the story like a cloth polishing silver to make it shine clearly in my mind. The baby, though, that was a surprise. I found out I was pregnant 3 weeks after Reeve told me he couldn't see me any longer. I'm going to skip a little bit ahead. Now we rarely speak other than to discuss Emily or her schedule or when I see him to either drop her off or pick her up from his place. It's possible to get over your attraction to someone. It just takes time and the ability to move the feelings to the corner of your mind where they pop up only occasionally, similar to old acquaintances at the grocery store, sometimes welcome, sometimes not. It's not ideal. Co-parenting never is, but Emily, who is 5 now, loves to spend time with her daddy and his dog, McKay. So when I get the call from Reeve on a chilly early November day, I assume it has something to do with Emily, that he needs to reschedule his weekend with her for a work excursion, which irritates me because I know if he misses the little time he has with her, she'll be sad. But the second I hear his voice, I sense something's up because he sounds a little breathless and worried. "What's up?" I ask, sitting at my desk in my office in Kalispell.
The day is cloudy and dim, so I have my desk lamp on, and it's exposing every bit of dust on the black chrome frame furniture, even though I dust the damn thing all the time. "Allie," he says after clearing his throat, "I need your help." "Help?" Reeve Landon doesn't ask for help any more than I do, so I pause before saying more. "Allie," he says again, his voice slightly rising, a trace of worry in the pitch of it, which is also unusual. "You still there?" "I'm here. What kind of help?" "I need you to go to my place. I need you to get McKay and take care of him for a few hours, just until I can sort out a few things. I'd ask Wallace, but he's just left for the winter." Now I know it's serious. Reeve rarely parts with his dog. He's worked with McKay for at least 5 years as part of a detection canine program that performs conservation and biological research. Apparently, there's a lot you can learn from the poop animals leave behind. It didn't take me long to understand, a few months after we began seeing each other, that the program and the dog are lifelines for Reeve. I get that. I've got a few of those myself, mainly Emily and my job. "The training is an ongoing process," Reeve has said more times than I can count, especially when he's making excuses for why he can't be there for Emily. According to Reeve, he's the only one who understands how to keep the dog on a schedule. He's taught Emily a little, but she's way too young to understand. "Watch McKay. Why? Where are you?" Reeve doesn't answer at first, and silence hangs between us on the line. "Reeve," I press, "where are you? Whose line are you using?" "I'm at the county building, at the sheriff's office. I'm using one of their landlines. I don't know how long I'll be here." "How long you'll be there? What's going on?" "I don't know. I think they think I've done something. I've already been here for 4 hours. They've been questioning me, making me go over the same information over and over, but mostly I've been doing a lot of sitting and waiting. They're inspecting my phone, so I had to use theirs to call you. But look, I have to go. The officer wants me to hang up now." "Wait," I say. "They're looking at your phone?" "They asked to see it. What are they saying you've done?" "I'm not sure," he says. "But whatever they think, it's not true." "What's not true?" "I don't know. That I've got something to do with whatever is up with that journalist." "What journalist?" He pauses, then sighs. "I'm not positive, but I think something has happened to her, and whatever it is, they think I'm involved." The sense of something icy, like a cold hand, presses against my neck and moves down my spine. "Listen, Allie, the spare key to my cabin is under the tin can in the back," and just like that, he's gone, the line blank.
So, questions? So it's not a completely new thing to do an ensemble series. A lot of authors have actually done that type of a series. I mean, off the top of my head, Tana French has done it with the Dublin Murder Mystery series. I think even C.J. Box lately, I think, did something with a different character, right? But that's different because he had been with his Joe Pickett for forever. But there are quite a few ensemble series out there. Elizabeth George has done that with her characters, and it just, I mentioned it earlier, I just really like to play out the entire arc of a character. And so I think if you're going to write a character for over a long period of books, that you really have to think about how you're going to spread that arc of that character out over that. And maybe I'm just too impatient or not seasoned enough yet to do that. I hope maybe one day I will have one character that I feel like I can do that book after book after book, but I didn't feel like I was at the spot where I could or wanted to do that. I do have one character, his name is Monty, and he's in Mortal Fall, the second book, and I didn't feel like I was completely done with him, and so he actually is in the third book. So I carry him forward a little bit, but he's not, he makes a little cameo appearance in this, but I'm not in his head, but I am in his head in Mortal Fall and in The Weight of Night as a secondary character. So Gretchen is my main character in The Weight of Night, a female. But I kind of switch back between her head and his, similar to what I do. So the next chapter in this book starts off with Reeve's voice. And so we follow him through, what's going on with the situation with the journalist and all that. I liked Monty, and so I liked him a lot, and I wanted to explore more about him. So I plucked him from the wild inside. So does that answer your question? Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to say I will never write a series character. I might do that. I just not yet. Just hadn't done that yet. So, but I do get a lot of emails from people like, are we going to go back to Monty and Gretchen? Are we going to go back to Ted? Or, you know, what's, you know, people like to find out what happens to these characters in the long run. So, yeah. So a little bit of both. I do tend to kind of make my way in the dark with, I don't have it all outlined. I do write, to use the metaphor that E.L. Doctorow put out there, I do write as far as the headlights kind of, and don't know everything that's going to happen. Sometimes I wish that I was more of an outliner. It would make my life a little easier because I do get very frustrated sometimes in the middle of it. Like, where's this going? I'm not sure. I'm in the middle of a mess. Yet sometimes, writing yourself into a mess is the best thing, because if you write yourself into a corner, trying to figure out how to back out of that corner can be a really great way to end up with twists or different things that are really great in suspense. So if you don't know where it's going, you know, you do have a chance of having things being suspenseful, because it's not like you're writing trying to disguise where, you know, you're not writing trying to disguise where exactly you know it's going to go to. So it can be a benefit to write suspense without knowing that. But I know so many writers, some are outliners, some are not. So everybody's just different. It's just your creative process. Some books I know who did it or who the perpetrator is. But not with all of them. So with this one, I didn't know for most of the book. Yeah. But for example, with The Wild Inside, I did know who did it, and I kind of wrote toward that endpoint, but I didn't know what all the chapters in between were going to be about. So I kind of just let that, maybe a little subconscious spoke to me, but more it was kind of going, seeing, like I said, as far as the head, like, where's the story taking me? I can see this far. I need to solve this problem. He's at this part in the investigation, so this needs to be done next. And so then I would kind of write that. And then when I write that, some new things would crop up. And then I'd have to deal with that and then just keep pushing forward like that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Or I end up having to cut stuff because it's like, this just isn't pertinent enough, or it's not effective enough, or maybe it's a little boring because I'm just exploring and there's no place for it once the final draft is there. So yeah, you have to, we say kill our babies. You have to kill the babies. You have to like delete. It's painful after you spent time writing it down, but we get used to that. Okay. So how did I come up with Reeve's backstory? So a lot of the things that I come up with for ideas, not all of them, but couple of them have come from things that have just caught my interest in the news or things I've read. And so, for example, Gretchen in The Weight of Night has a sleep disorder. She has something called parasomnia. And I had read a really interesting article, and then I had read about the comedian Birbiglia, who has this sleep disorder and who had been dreaming and got up in the middle of the night and ran through his glass windows and fell two stories down because he thought he was running from bad guys who were chasing him. And that's kind of the way that sleep disorder works. It's just your body doesn't shut down appropriately. So if you have a nightmare, you will often act it out. And in that article, I had read about a guy in England who had actually dreamt that his wife was a demon and he strangled her, and this is real, and he woke up and he was just like mortified that he had done this and called the cops, and he was not sentenced because they proved that it was a sleep disorder and that he didn't do it on, it wasn't intentional. They did all sorts of EEGs on him and realized that he really did have this legitimate sleep disorder. And I think other people have tried to use that as a defense. There was a man, I want to say Arizona, but I'm not sure. It's been a while now since I researched all that, who tried to use that defense. And the jury's still out about whether he actually had that sleep disorder or not, but they wouldn't buy it. They wouldn't believe him. They thought he was just using that as an excuse to get off on killing his wife. But so the whole thing fascinated me, and I just thought, what would it be like to have this guilt of doing something that you didn't intentionally do, but because you have you know, sleep disorder. I mean, I imagine it'd be like drunk driving and killing a family accidentally and you didn't, but at least you'd know, okay, I have something I can specifically feel guilty for. I went and I got drunk, and that, like, that's as bad, as common as that is and as awful as that is, it's still something you did that you brought upon yourself. But to have something that you didn't do, that you didn't, like, it's a sleep disorder, yeah, that you consciously didn't even make a decision for, it kind of fascinated me in that. So I wrote about that in The Weight of Night, and I feel like that's the same for Reeve. Like, at that age, 9 years old, finding a gun and, you know, playing, looking for a Nintendo, and that just kind of, again, that kind of shook me. I read an article about, not that exact thing, but something similar. I mean, we read those articles all the time, you know, the little kid that pulls the gun out in the grocery store and shoots their mom, and then, you know, they have to live. And then I'm not making statements, you know, about the political, the Second Amendment. I'm not, I mean, I know that's a very charged, divided, divisive issue in the United States. And so I was careful not to, be political in the book. I don't really get political in the book. I just kind of, Reeve is kind of this interesting guy who, he doesn't want to enter that debate. He's like, you know, I don't want to talk about that. That's like, I want to be left alone. Like, this country is crazy about that. And I don't even want to enter that, even though he has this backstory. So in a way, he's like, wants to take this really neutral position, partly for survival, but partly because maybe symbolically, like, there has to be some middle ground where people can have a discussion, whereas I don't even think we can anymore. I mean, it's gotten to the point where the pro-gun and the pro-common-sense gun control can't even really have a very effective conversation. So I didn't want to get into that too much. I mean, I'm writing a crime fiction novel, and my job is to create suspense and entertain. But at the same time, I don't want to completely skirt my issue or skirt the issues or evade my duty as an author with a voice. And so some of my ideas come from articles like that. And then sometimes they come from just something that I've heard or seen, or sometimes even a Pilates client has said something interesting to me in the past that sticks with me. And yeah. Like I said, the first two books I wrote were not in the genre. They were non-genre. I wanted them to be kind of Oprah Book Club books. That was like my thought, because that they were really big back then, Oprah Book Club books in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then I took that long period of time off that I mentioned. And so I think I mentioned that I just wanted to be really deliberate about it and to dive into what I really enjoy reading. And I enjoy crime fiction. I was a little afraid of true crime. And I've only read a couple true crime books because they freak me out a little bit, because they're not fiction and it's scary. And, you know, I come from Gainesville. Actually, Reeve comes from Tallahassee, but I actually am a Florida native, and I come from Gainesville, Florida. And I remember when I moved to Montana in eighth grade, similar to Ted. And I remember at the time the whole Ted Bundy thing had gone on. And then years later, I was at a writer's conference. This was when I was writing those first two non-genre novels. I went to a local writer's conference called the River Writers Conference, Flathead River Writers Conference, I believe. And it was held at Grouse Mountain Lodge in Whitefish, Montana. And it was really cool because they had these really phenomenal writers that came in, like Anne Rule, who's a true crime writer, was there. And she stood up and she was telling these fascinating stories about growing up, you know, around her dad's prison. He was like, he ran a prison, and she grew up in the small town near the, you know, hanging out in the prison, in, you know, in the county. I think it was a county. And she just, you know, she was around it, and you could see how she got fascinated with it. Well, that wasn't me at all. I mean, and she wrote a book about Ted Bundy, and I remember buying it and having her sign it, and I couldn't open it. I was like, I'm not going to read this. I mean, like, there's no way I'm going to sit here as a young woman and read this. So I need to find that book, though, because I think I could read it now. I do. But so true crime is a little bit frightening to me, but I have kind of started to dip my toes into it. But the fiction thing, and it's so weird, like, why do women love to read? Because women are like huge readers, huge consumers of fiction crime, you know, and men too, but women really, really like it. And I don't know where that comes from. And, but I just think that it's a way of grappling with violence and a way of grappling with our world. And even though we know it's fiction, so it's like safety, like, cause we know it's fiction and we know it's made up. And so there's a safety with it, but there's also a way of diving into it a little bit and getting closer to it and maybe trying to understand it without just completely ignoring it, but doing it kind of in a little bit of a safe way, if that makes sense. And so, for me, it's the same thing when I write it. I feel a little bit safe because it's fiction, but I do have to go to dark places in my mind. And I guess I've realized as I've gotten older that I guess I'm a little dark.